Hello, and welcome to episode 5, the November issue of the monthly governance podcast by One Publicis Team Samsung. My name's Danny, I'm the business director. I joined the team over 3 months ago. And I'm excited to introduce today a very special guest to our November issue. We are welcoming Steve Ranger, editor-in-chief at ZDNet and TechPublic, which are part of the CBS Interactive Group, who also have brands such as CNET, who are a huge partner for Samsung globally. We're going to be covering off a couple of different topics today, everything from AI through to cybersecurity, digital transformation, and blockchain. And rather than me sit here and tell you a bit about those, I'm going to hand over to Steve to give a bit of an introduction to himself and what he does, and we'll get into the topic straight away.
Hello. Well, thanks for having me. So, I look after ZDNet and TechRepublic, which are two of the big business titles that we have, which means we write about everything from artificial intelligence through to new devices, through to government policy, through to pretty much anything that involves a business audience and technology. We will cover it across ZDNet and TechRepublic, either through news or through video or through features. Basically, if it happens in tech, in business, then we're going to cover it.
Great. So I feel like I'm in the presence of journalistic royalty here. You've got a few awards to your name. It'd be good to kind of kick off and understand a bit about where we think that the world is moving. You know, we've got subjects such as AI and cybersecurity and blockchain that are, I guess, at the forefront of the industry at the moment. I'm particularly interested to understand blockchain. It's a subject which has, you know, been topical in all of the news over the last few months. Where do you think, beyond financial services, you can see interesting ways of this developing within the marketplace?
I think it's a really interesting one. Blockchain is this kind of incredibly hyped, incredibly kind of potentially exciting technology that right now is struggling to break out from being regarded largely for its cryptocurrency roots. So everyone knows about Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is built on blockchain. And blockchain is this ledger, this kind of database that can't be altered once it's created. So it creates this incredibly strong kind of like a way of recording information. So that's really useful in some respects. And with a cryptocurrency, that's quite handy because it helps underpinning that. Once you get beyond that, there are lots of potentially interesting applications for it. Right now, they're quite thin on the ground because everyone can see this is an interesting technology. And they're trying to think out, well, okay, what can we do with it? It creates this kind of like permanent record of everything you've done if with a transaction. How can we use that in the real world? So there are ways you can use it. So for example, in a land registry, you could use it to make sure that this is one of the real world success at the moment. You can use it to register when a piece of land is sold, and there's no way you can unregister that piece of take that piece of land away again because it's in the blockchain. It's clearly there and it's owned by me and it's not owned by you. And obviously, if you're working in a territory where things like, you know, land gets stolen, then being able to prove the ownership of something is really, really good. And having that publicly provable is actually really important. When you move away from niche examples like that, I think it's less clear where the general application of it is going to be. I think there are lots of issues holding it back right now. The technology isn't robust enough. It's quite slow compared to other technologies. But the idea of it, you could use it in, you know, to create an identity that is never lost. You can create it, obviously, people using it for cryptocurrency. I think there are lots of potentials. I think if there is a kind of a one big use that's going to come out of it, we haven't found it yet, beyond the kind of the utopian ideas of having a currency that isn't owned by anyone. And that's one of the attractions to some people of Bitcoin, is it's not owned by a central government, it's owned by them to a certain extent. But and that's, I think, that's kind of a remarkable achievement in and of itself. But actually finding other uses beyond that, I think, a bit of a struggle right now.
That's for me, I've always struggled to understand beyond cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. So when I think about blockchain, I think about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin. So it's interesting to understand the broader possible opportunities, even though they may be niche. Do you think there are any businesses or any organizations at the moment that are using it particularly either well or have figured out a way to make it really applicable for their market?
One of the most obvious areas is financial services, where they can use it to record transactions. And there is some potential there for sure. And as I say, in other areas where you need that kind of radical transparency, you need to be able to prove a transaction took place and it can't be taken back again. Those are the sorts of places right now where the experiments are going on, and I think the benefits will be found. There is lots of talk down the line about things like using blockchain to secure medical records, which seems like an interesting idea until you think, well, one of the things that people like about blockchain is that it's transparent and you can see everything. So do you really want to use this blockchain to secure your medical record and also expose your medical records to the world? You know, there's lots of different things. There's lots of different questions that come in. If you're using blockchain, for example, to secure personal information, well, then it might bump up against something like GDPR, which says that any personal information can be kind of like deleted at some point. Can't delete stuff from a blockchain. So if you use it for personal information, you got yourself kind of like into a bit of a situation. So I think realistically, real world benefits of this, as I say, beyond the kind of the utopian cryptocurrency kind of stuff, 5-10 years maybe before we get to anything that's kind of like real world, so changing
still
the world.
Way off.
I think so, just because a lot of the technology is quite immature, and I think a lot of people are looking for, it's a really interesting technology, looking for an application, and it needs to get a lot more stable and it needs to get a lot more real world. But it's interesting stuff, right? And people are still writing about it and trying to figure out how to use it. But I'm not sure everyone's come up with a best case of that yet.
So it helps you produce column inches, but actually the realities aren't there right now.
Yeah, the enthusiasm is still there.
I guess that links quite nicely to, you know, cybersecurity. This is something in which lots of brands are owning the conversation around cybersecurity, especially in the B2B space. So we've seen Hiscox. They've been incredibly vocal and certainly been advertising a fair amount as to, you know, how aware or worried is the average person in that their choice of device could impact or compromise their own security. Do you think consumers are more or less personally accountable in this space, or does it sit with the organizations that hold the data themselves?
Well, I think this is, you know, one of the most interesting things we write about at the moment. And we write about security and security issues on a daily and sometimes hourly basis. You know, this is something that goes absolutely to the heart of, you know, the digital economy, goes to the heart of our existences now, because if you go back 10 or 15 years, then much less of our personal lives was online and stored online. And now pretty much everything about your life is in your pocket, right? It's your photos, it's your contacts, it's all your messages. It's pretty much everything about you. And now if that gets stolen or encrypted by ransomware or something, you've got a big problem. And that's a problem that is a very modern problem to have. So I think the responsibility for security, it goes from top to bottom, right? So, you know, we talk to a lot of consultants who will say, this is an issue for CEOs and for CFOs and for, you know, the tops of business to say, well, our business is now digital because every business is pretty much digital these days. We need to secure these assets in a way that is, you know, means our business can continue to exist, because without this stuff, we are nothing. I'm not sure every CFO or CEO understands that. So, you know, I think there is work to be done there. But there's also at the individual level, or, you know, whether that's in work of making sure that you aren't sharing your passwords or sticking your password on a post-it note and sticking it under your desk or browsing inappropriate sites or all that kind of thing. There's a personal responsibility. And I think there's a responsibility as an individual as well as a consumer, right? And I think your responsibility goes across all of those, and where one stops and when the next one starts is sometimes, you know, hard to tell, because increasingly we use consumer devices for work, whether that's in the evening, you're just tapping something up on a laptop, or you're just researching something on your smartphone on the way to work. You know, where work ends and where, you know, play starts is increasingly kind of like hard to tell. And that means you have to have the sort of same security awareness and think about that in terms of the devices you're buying and the way you treat them. So yeah, it's a huge issue. It's something that is very close to the hearts of our readers, because some of them are those CEOs and those CFOs who are trying to understand and create a kind of a security culture. A lot of them, those business decision makers who are trying to decide which pieces of hardware to buy, whether to buy this laptop, that smartphone, that kind of thing. And also they carry that into their consumer life as well, where they're trying to understand, how do I protect myself? What should I back up? What should I do and what should I not do? So I think your kind of question is about, you know, in terms of devices people buy. I think there is an increasing sense that privacy and security is something you have to expect when you're buying any sorts of products. I think the days when you just buy a device and kind of hope it would be okay, those kind of, that's going. I think there is a premium for security. There is a premium for privacy, and I think that's inevitable. You know, there's a certain number of consumers, and certainly businesses, absolutely, that will be attracted to that because they need to know they're secure for all sorts of reasons, whether it's because they don't want their brand reputation damaged or because they don't want you know, to get themselves fined by data protection authorities. You know, there's lots of issues out there right now.
And we, as an organisation, so Samsung, we have a really unique proposition in Knox and in the hardware and software that we were able to offer, certainly to businesses. How do you think it fares to other devices in the marketplace? Certainly when we consider actually there is little distinction between, let's call it, B2C audiences and B2B audiences. And as you said, people will find it, you know, difficult to distinguish between work and play. Do you think, you know, Knox is an attractive offer? You know, do you think there's anyone else out there that's currently covering this off in any great length or any great detail?
So I definitely think this idea that privacy is a competitive advantage is definitely a kind of a growing trend. I think absolutely the idea that if you cannot secure your if there is a sense you can't secure your devices, then I think, you know, customers are, you know, rightly not interested so much. I think that's something that's changed maybe over the last maybe 2 or 3 years. I think that awareness has come in. I think as devices like smartphones have matured, we're looking for the next thing that's really important about them, whether it's like screen size or what camera or whatever. But I also think that privacy and security have become part of that. So you certainly see the big brands pushing that forward and making, I think that's actually a really good competitive differentiator to be able to say that, well, if, you know, this device is more secure or will keep you safer. I think that's something that a savvy consumer really should be wanting to look for. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. You know, we've also seen over the last 4 or 5 years, lots of investment within the, I guess, world of digital transformation. And when we think about consumers, I don't think consumers really see digital as a thing. It's just endemic. It's in our lives. It's every day, you know, through our devices, how we transact, you know, how we move ourselves about the city, you know, lots of different ways that, you know, digital comes to life. Do you think it's odd that brands still see it as a distinct channel? And I'm keen to understand which brands you really think have embraced digital transformation, and, you know, who we should probably keep our eyes on from that space.
Yeah, I think if you think of digital transformation as the kind of the acknowledgement that everything is digital now, and that you can't hive it off into a small separate section like, oh, we've got a website, right? That's not really what digital transformation is talking about. It's talking about taking all the processes in your business and saying, well, do these make sense when kind of like from a digital point of view, whether that's to our customers, to our clients, to us as workers, you know, these systems that have grown up over maybe 20 years, maybe 50 years to fit with old ways of doing things. You may well find that you can streamline those or change those or make those a lot more effective through digital technologies. And that could be all sorts of things from just the simple use of spreadsheets or through to artificial intelligence and the Internet of Things and quantum computing, right? These are all kind of like the ingredients of creating a digital business. But what you're really saying is that we will no longer be bound by the models of 50 years ago or 20 years ago. The issue for that with most organizations is not the technology. They're quite good at going out and buying new technology. They're just really hard at changing their business processes and changing their structures to say that, well, you know, that we can change. The cultural issue is huge. The cultural barriers to change are, when we talk to CIOs, when we talk to CEOs about this, those are the things that come up first. Usually the money is not the issue. Usually someone can find you money to do to buy whatever it is you need to buy. The issue is explaining to all those line managers or to individual staff that what they do has to change. And that change is often uncomfortable. But if you're trying to change what the business does and you're trying to be more responsive to customers or you're trying to just change something kind of quite fundamental, then that cultural thing is always the biggest change. I mean, in terms of brands that are pushing this forward, I mean, I think you just have to look at some of those, any of those like leading companies, those leading retailers that have rebuilt themselves for the digital world, where the shop is just one of those touch points along with your smartphone or your smartwatch or whatever, that they aren't necessarily saying, well, we've had shops on high street for a long time, therefore we are a high street shop. You could have kind of like transmute yourself into something else that might be more like a brand rather than something that's just held in particular a piece of bricks and mortar. You have to be more adaptable than that, and that's where these digital technologies come in, because they can make you absolutely much faster to respond to changes, which means that today's digitally transformed company may be very different in a year's time, because it gives you that flexibility to move fast.
We saw it with M&S recently, and I don't think digital transformation necessarily has been a huge issue for them. I think there's been lots of other market factors that have played into that, whether that's, you know, their lack of being able to keep up with fast fashion, you know, the likes of a Misguided, a Boohoo. But, you know, as an organisation, you would sit there and say, you know, M&S are a British institution that are fundamentally fallen behind. Do you think digital contributes towards that? Or do you think they actually, someone like that, really kind of did get ahead of it a few years ago when they reinvented shop and, you know, certainly tried to invest in changing how they operated as a business?
I mean, if you look at the high street, the high street is a really great example of the huge change that's going on. And obviously, if you walk down any high street and you see empty shops, not everyone is making that leap. And I think, you know, for example, retail is much more now about experience shopping, for example, rather than just about shifting goods, or at least it is for a certain chunk of the high street, right? So, yeah, I think it's very hard to say there is one way of doing digital transformation, because it applies in so many different ways to so many different organisations. But I think it is about that idea of flexibility and using technology to be as flexible as possible, because the different sort of micro challenges of every organisation will vary massively. But if you are so kind of like rigidly stuck in your ways, whether you're a new business or an old business, then you won't be able to react in time. And what we're seeing now is that kind of like the pace of change, which is always accelerating, has absolutely accelerated to a point where you have to be flexible.
When we consider how Samsung are evolving as a business, you know, we are a digitally led business to an extent. 5G is going to be a pretty big topic for us. And I know that you guys have been covering this off in quite great detail. It's huge for Samsung. Apart from Huawei, they're the only handset provider to be able to offer that 5G capability. Do you think the jump from 4G to 5G will have the same impact on consumers as jumping from 3G to 4G did? Or do you think it will change other areas more than it will just change day-to-day life?
I think there were such big jumps when you jumped from 1G as it was to 2G, and then to 2G to 3G, and 3G to 4G. Those were all really, really, really big jumps, you know, going from just a phone that could, you know, you could talk on to data, to video. I don't think in some respects 5G will be as big a change, because it's not adding kind of particularly sort of like new stuff on top of that. But what it is making all those other things absolutely possible in the real world. So there was always this idea that even on 4G you could kind of like stream video, and even on 3G you could stream video. Actually, you know, the real world example of that, the experience of that wasn't so great. 5G, theoretically, the real world experience of that will be great, and that there won't be any lag, and that you won't be dropping calls all the time, and that actually the experience will be really, really good. So I think in the short term, we may not see much change. And, you know, I've been up on the roofs looking at the aerials and stuff like that, which is quite good fun. And it will gradually roll out from the urban centres to the rest of the country and more broadly around the world. But I think give it a year or two and you will start seeing those new kind of intriguing applications coming through. I mean, absolutely, we'll all be consuming much more video than we do now. And we already consume loads of video, and 5G will absolutely support that. Absolutely, things like gaming will be great, because there'll be, you know, much less latency. So these things will really actually work in the real world. Some of the things I'm quite interested in are things like augmented reality and virtual reality. So at the moment, if you're doing augmented reality, which is where you're overlaying digital stuff on the real world through your phone, again, it's quite laggy and it's not great. With 5G, that should be really sharp. And actually, you can see that we will be much more comfortable with using these phones, and who knows, maybe a few years down the line, some sort of smart glasses, as a kind of like a way of seeing the world differently, seeing the world not as it is around us, but also with these kind of like digital things added. And you see a bit of that with things like with Google Maps. You can get like pointers to places, you know, big arrows to tell you which direction to go, overlaid on your smartphone, what you can see through your smartphone. And that kind of stuff, I think, will just grow and grow, because something like 5G will give you the bandwidth to make those things happen. I also think it will allow you to bring in all sorts of different shapes and sizes of devices, you know, new form factors like folding phones or smaller phones or bigger phones or different devices, because what 5G allows you is vastly more connections to the network. So you can basically make anything 5G. You can have, you know, anything you want that you could conceivably put some sort of like 5G antenna into, you can make it happen. So from tiny sensors to anything, really. So the whole world around you suddenly becomes much more interactive and much more alive with technology, because 5G lets you do that.
Talk about alive with technology, you know, artificial intelligence is starting to come to the fore more more so now than ever. And we were talking on our way in about, you know, Elon Musk and the success that he's had, and just first and foremost, just growing, you know, a brand from nothing, be that Tesla, into what is now, I guess, the third biggest auto brands in the US alone. What do you think will be at the forefront of this next AI revolution? You know, Elon Musk will surely be at the heart of that. And as I said before, you know, genius or madman, he is creating some, you know, fantastic innovations. So where do you think it's going to go?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously he's an interesting one, Elon Musk, on this one, because his attitude towards AI, and certainly towards the sort of the general kind of AI where we would think of as the super intelligent kind of like, that kind of stuff. He's pretty down on that and quite, you know, sees that as kind of like, you know, potentially the end of the human race, which is, you know, a bit of a downer. But but there's lots of different types of AI, and there's AI all around us already. I mean, AI, if you think of AI as a way of basically making better decisions with data and using it, so algorithms that decide to route your car which way in the morning or that kind of thing, that's AI. When a chatbot on a bank website talks back to you rather than a human being, that's AI as well. So there are really trivial low levels of AI which are actually making our lives slightly better. They're taking some of that kind of friction out of our lives. And actually at the moment, that's kind of like, that's great, right? And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have the kind of the AI that's going to steal your job and replace you. So the truth is inevitably somewhere in between all of these things, that AI is being used, certainly in business, an awful lot already. And mostly you wouldn't even notice it because it's being used in pretty humdrum ways, you know, is to help decide whether you get that car loan or to, as I say, help decide which way your route you take to get to the office in the morning, that kind of thing. This the sort of the grand idea of AI taking over the world, I think that's a long way away, hopefully.
Maybe not with 5G.
Well, who knows, right? But actually, you see how these trends build on each other and reinforce each other. So we've been talking about digital transformation, which creates vast amounts of data. We've been talking about 5G, which creates vast amounts of data and the Internet of Things. And then all this feeds into artificial intelligence, because where we're creating all these huge amounts of data, we need something to crunch it and analyze it and understand it. And that's where the artificial intelligence comes in. We just have to make sure that the decisions it makes are the right ones, and it's not taking into account factors that we don't want it to take into account, like when it's calculating your car loan, it should be absolutely calculating the car loan and nothing else about your life or who you are. And shouldn't be taking those things into account. It should take into account what we want it to take into account. So there's a lot of, you know, concern about AI decision making, but really AI is a kind of a mirror that reflects the good and the bad in us. And if we make AI do bad things, then it will be bad. And if we think about the things we want to put in, the inputs and the decision making processes we want it to follow, then it should be good, as long as we're going into it with kind of like the right attitude.
And There are subtle, I guess, innovations within AI, as you said, lots of things day to day that we interact with that are forms of AI. What do you think is either the most notable build within AI that we interact with in day to day life? So something that's, you know, either physical or digital. You know, what have you seen out there that's either impressive and you can see it shifting, and where have you seen kind of some of those bad investments, as you say, because there's good and bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I really has wowed me over the last few years, I guess, is voice. You know, the way that we can now talk to a digital assistant and it will understand us and will kind of like converse with us. You know, whether that's Alexa or Siri or whoever. You know, the idea that we have trained these machines to understand all of the ways we speak in and kind of like the nuances and that kind of thing. Now, obviously, there's miles and miles to go, right? But just from a sheer wow point of view, it's just that kind of like that voice interaction, which I remember watching, you know, Star Trek as a kid and thinking, wow, you can talk to the ship. How cool is that, right? We can do that now. You can talk to your house. You can talk to your smartphone and it will answer you. Not always making any sense, but that idea that I just think that kind of is just, to me, is just fascinating and kind of incredible. I think there are loads of bad examples of AI as well, that where we, as I say, a lot of it comes down to the inputs we put in, the data we put in, and the decisions we're asking it to make. And if we make that decision-making system flawed in the first place, then what comes out the other end is wrong. So if, you know, if it's your car loan and it doesn't come out because of kind of like extraneous reasons, which we didn't necessarily understand that we were putting into this system, but we did, then that's the sort of thing you've got to worry about. And yeah, it's kind of all around us now. So we kind of have to, sometimes you have to stop and look around you and try and understand how kind of incredible this kind of like technology we're surrounding ourselves with, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Mostly it's a good thing, but I think if it is a bad thing, we need to stop and say and kind of change that, because we still have that chance.
Thinking about Samsung as a business, you know, you've probably covered lots of different innovations from them over the years. What would be your advice to them and how they should, you know, move forward? You know, we discussed briefly before telemedicine, something we covered in the previous episode of the podcast. What do you think is the future for Samsung beyond what you can see as the roadmap?
Oh gosh, right. I mean, I don't know. I don't give advice because I'm far too wrong all the time, to be honest, to give any advice to anyone. And that's one of the good things about being a journalist, is that you get to see how wrong you are all the time.
Okay. If not advice, where do you think you can see their, you know, their role in technology, playing a bigger part in people's lives?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of those things you kind of mentioned there is health, and I think absolutely health is a vast area where we're just kind of like absolutely just scratching the surface of that. I mean, at the most trivial level now, we all mostly carry around a phone that will record our steps or record our activity. Now, that's really interesting information, right? That tells, you know, an awful lot about you and your habits and your behaviours and kind of your health. But that is in no way connected to what your doctor sees. So it's very rare that any of that information is ever getting anywhere near your GP, getting anywhere near your patient record, right?
Yeah.
So bridging that gap between the kind of incredible technology we carry around in our pockets at all times and what you get in a GP surgery, for example, is immense, right? The you know, it's only in the last year that the NHS has stopped buying fax machines because they've been using them forever, right? And they're quite good in certain places. But actually, when we're talking about digital transformation earlier, we're talking about making things joined up and making them make more sense. Well, wouldn't it be great if your medical record could be updated with the fact that, oh, maybe you're taking less steps every day. Maybe over 2 or 3 years you've started to reduce your physical activity. And maybe that's something that, you know, kind of like a lifestyle change, but maybe that's something that you want to look into, and maybe you get a call from your GP saying, hey, have you slowed down a bit recently? How are you feeling? And maybe there's nothing to it. But, you know, that kind of joined upness is really interesting, because we have all these different things, all these different bits of information in different silos around the place. But we can't connect them up because of all sorts of reasons around privacy. And you may not want to be sharing that information with your GP. Completely understandable. But I think healthcare is one of those last big areas where things like the Internet of Things and artificial intelligence and sensors and 5G, all that kind of stuff can come together and actually make really kind of like big and meaningful changes to the world. This is like we did a kind of like a big special report on last year, looking at all these different technologies, saying how do they fit in with healthcare? And most of them have got a really great place in healthcare. Obviously, funding is an issue, and that cultural change thing's an issue, because obviously, clinicians want to spend their money on making people better, rightly. But so there's a kind of conversation to be had there. But healthcare is a huge, huge area.
Great, thank you. I think we've covered quite a lot today, some really interesting ground. So thanks for that, Steve. Please join us next month, and we'll be covering off lots of other interesting topics in our December festive issue.